Should we fear Iraq? Should you fear Iraq? Iraqis, right where you live. Does the United States have any reason to fear Iraq? You know what's been in the news lately. And of course, by the time this tape-recorded message reaches you, who knows what can develop in the Middle East? When Saddam Hussein expelled UN investigators who were attempting to survey plants suspected of manufacturing chemical and biological weapons, the world once again was brought to the brink of a major war in the Persian Gulf region. And now, even though those who were expelled have been allowed back, the very first thing we find out is that there is additional delay and obfuscation, and that they are beginning again to indicate that they maybe want to kick the Americans out of there. All the major news media, television, newspapers, news magazines began reporting hour-by-hour developments as the United States sent a second carrier battle group, the USS George Washington, together with a cruiser, destroyer, and an attack submarine to augment a large number of ships already in the Gulf supporting the nuclear carrier Nimitz. In the very early days of this crisis, Russia, France, and China proved reluctant to back strident U.S. demands that Iraq return to the status quo ante, the way things were before, and allow the weapons inspectors back into the country to do their jobs. And then, if you remember, it was a surprise move when Boris Yeltsin of Russia sent a letter to Saddam Hussein outlining a Russian plan for a diplomatic solution. It seemed to work. Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz of Iraq flew to Moscow to hand Yeltsin a personal reply from Hussein, which Madeleine Albright, U.S. Secretary of State, was meeting with many other world leaders at the very same time, including heads of state from Germany and France in Geneva. And eventually, as we know now, Saddam appeared to back down. Yet the Iraqis continue to scream about U-2 flights. They continue to obfuscate and try to resist the U.N. Commission under Richard Butler to do their work. They have effected a massive relocation of their air defenses. The media reported that the Iraqi air defenses in southern Iraq were now heavier than at any time during Desert Storm. Just as television news pictured huge American B-52 bombers lifting off from Barksdale Air Force Base near Bossier City, Louisiana, word came that the Iraqis had decided to allow the inspectors back into the country. And since that time, we know that thousands more American troops have been airlifted to the region, and we know that even B-1 bombers have been dispatched to that area, along with the F-117 stealth fighter bombers that were so featured in the war in the Gulf in 1991 and 2. The unanswered specter of fear is not lost on the Pentagon or on nearby Israel, and that is this. What did the Iraqis manage to move around and hide during the more than 2 weeks that the inspectors were out of country? What is behind Saddam Hussein's maneuverings? Is there a reason why the world should be afraid of Saddam Hussein? And what does Bible prophecy say is ahead for the Middle East? Is Israel under any threat from Iraq? In a recent television program, perhaps the one in which I mentioned this clipping and those of you that wrote for this tape or called for it heard at least excerpts of it, there was an article saying Saddam should make you afraid, written by A.M. Rosenthal of the New York Times newspaper. It was sent to me by a gentleman in Des Moines, Iowa, and was reprinted in the Des Moines, Iowa Register back on October 19, 1997. He said, "This is a mystery story without a mystery. Everybody involved knows the key. Terrorists, anti-terrorists, U.S. officials, America's allies, enemies, and sunshine friends. But they do not want to utter it." He said, "Before this column ends, you will know it too, and be afraid." Oh yeah, there's lots of fear out there, lots of things to be afraid of, and of course, the media really hypes that because people, especially overseas, like those poor helpless tourists that were down in Egypt, in Upper Egypt, as they call it, but Southern Egypt to us, and were simply going along on tour buses, were suddenly machine gunned to death by fanatical Shiite Muslims who want to overthrow the government of Hosni Mubarak. Anyway, A.M. Rosenthal went on April 1, 1991, 1 month and a day after Saddam Hussein was defeated in the Persian Gulf War, the U.N. Security Council ordered Iraq to destroy all its germ warfare weapons, all stocks of germ war material, and all related subsystems and components, and all research, development, support, and manufacturing systems. The order was top priority for the United States and its allies because they knew that Saddam had amassed a huge supply of biological weapons. And those include such horrifying things as anthrax cultures, which if they were sprayed over a city in a light plane, could obliterate hundreds of thousands of lives in an agonizing death. Saddam has done that. He has amassed a huge supply of biological weapons. Those men knew that Iraq already had a large supply of suitable warheads and that germ warfare weapons are easy to deliver by crop duster or other small planes, and Iraq has plenty of those. They knew that one dusting of a city, as I just said, could kill as many people as did the Hiroshima bomb, and that was over 92,000 or so who died in one blast. They call it the poor man's nuclear bomb. They also knew that if Saddam did not want to do the job himself, he's got a full address book of terrorists who would, and many of them are sponsored by organizations in Syria as well as in Iran. Until July 1995, Iraq totally denied it had any bacteriological program. But since then, Iraq has presented three versions and four different drafts about the programs it previously denied existed. How these people lie. Lies, 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 continually. There is no truth. The United Nations Special Investigation Commission on Iraq found all of those drafts, all of those letters, to be full of lies and evasions and rejected all of them. On September 17, 1997, Iraq turned in a new report. On October 7th, the commission, which was headed by Robert Butler, an Australian, and a clear-minded and a clear-tongued Australian, he's very articulate, you've seen him interviewed on television, as I have several times, he reported on the last accounting that Iraq gave. And the commission, backed up by an international panel of experts, said it, quote, failed to give a remotely credible account of Iraq's biological weapons program, end of quote. So it was evasive, it was obfuscation, and it was filled with lies. It was no good at all. Instead, the commission report told that the same old Iraqi techniques to block the investigators, saying, well, don't come today, come next Wednesday, delays, evasions, and lies, locking inspectors out of key sites, shuffling weapons and materials around the country in the dark of night. The production in Iraq of materials used in biological warfare appears vastly understated, said that UN report. And in imports, material unaccounted for was enough to triple the supply just of anthrax that Iraq, listen, did concede that they had. Summed up, the adherence by supposedly defeated Iraq to the orders of the victors to destroy germ warfare weapons is, quote, unredeemed by progress or approximation of known facts, end quote, from the UN report about the Iraqi program. Then the mystery is presented. And what an incredible statement. Quote, listen to this. There is incomprehension of why Iraq is persisting so strongly with both refusing to make the facts known about its biological weapons program and why it is so insistent on blocking the commission's own efforts to reach those facts. Now, anybody, said A.M. Rosenthal, who has spent any time at the United Nations, understands that sentence to mean we most certainly do comprehend it, but we just don't like it. What everybody really comprehends is that easy manufacture and easy delivery over enemy cities or soldiers make biological weaponry so important to Saddam that he's perfectly willing to risk continued or even stronger sanctions against him, and it's obvious that he's willing to risk war. There was one man standing on a street corner in Baghdad the other day who was talking about the multiple millions of population Iraq has, a nation about the size of the state of California, and said, so if they attack us and 3 million or so of us die, so what? Isn't that incredible? You know, to the Western mind, that is incredible. That is absolutely unthinkable. You remember how, on an occasion when one of our young pilots was shot down over Bosnia, and his picture was right on the front page of Time and all these other magazines, and the entire nation was grieving and wondering about it. And when they got him back out of there, everybody was tearful and breathed a sigh of relief. Even one American life is so important to the United States that the whole government and the armed services get involved. Remember the face of that beaten pilot that was displayed by the Iraqis early on in the Operation Desert Shield or Desert Storm in the war in the Gulf, and how everyone grieved for him and his family? We don't understand a mind that says, sure, we can push you, and we can run over the UN resolutions, and we can expel people, and then if you hit us and you kill 3 million of us, so what? We got a lot of other millions there. We don't understand that kind of mentality. But you know, Saddam's decision is not really all that daring, because he knows the West believes that he already had his warheads loaded with bacteriological and chemical weapons, and the United Nations did nothing about it. I've told my audiences that for several years, that he had bacteriological and chemical weapons in warheads on those scuds, and there were articles that I read that were supposed to have been leaked from the Pentagon that said that he had actually ordered forward battlefield commanders to launch those warheads, which would have been bacteriological warfare, probably this deadly anthrax or smallpox or some hideously deadly chemical called VX, which is reportedly 7 times more powerful than that deadly sarin gas unleashed by Japanese terrorists several years ago in Tokyo subways. Saddam knows that while the United States and Britain would support stronger sanctions, they are opposed in the Security Council by Russia, China, France, Egypt, and other countries, all of whom, by the way, are lining up for future contracts with Iraq. They want to provide all kinds of infrastructure and systems and hardware and technology and the like to Iraq in return for Iraqi oil. And, of course, they want to get the revenue from the sale of Iraqi oil to other nations around the world. And so, of course, they would like to see all of those sanctions lifted, and they don't like them, don't go along with them, because all of those nations are hurting economically. The gall that they feel about all of this comes from knowing that when the United States talks about carrying out its laws against foreign companies building up terrorist states like Iraq and Iran, somebody in Washington nearly always puts out some dour stories about what that's going to do, backlash, how are the other Arab states going to react, what's it going to do to our allies, what's it going to do to Saudi Arabia, what's it going to do to Egypt? Translation. U.S. companies like Goldman Sachs, former Home of Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, might lose business. And that's supposed to frighten Americans so they will continue to accept the cash box as the one depository of American foreign policy. Well, you and I know. Saddam wanted it. He has worked for it. He has had his scientists and technicians developing it. And now he has it. Germ warfare power, which is the nuclear bomb of terrorist gangs and of terrorist dictators who really were not defeated after all. Well, some military people have been saying we should have gone in and taken him out. In early television interviews following the most recent upset in the Middle East, there were many who were saying that. As a matter of fact, George Stephanopoulos, a former White House aide, was even heard to say, to the shock of his own interviewer and the network itself, that somebody ought to go in there and assassinate the man. And, of course, many people said that they should have gone all the way to Baghdad and taken him out, and that, of course, was referring to President George Bush's decision to halt the war in the Gulf called Desert Storm in only 100 hours, deciding not to go on to Baghdad, even though the road to Baghdad lay open to massive, victorious Allied forces. People couldn't believe that Stephanopoulos was actually shocking his fellow panelists by saying that Saddam Hussein should be assassinated. But the United States has passed laws expressly forbidding using assassination as an option in military confrontations abroad. But many experts continue to agree that Saddam Hussein is the problem, and it would be a major step toward a solution if he, personally, could somehow be removed. And of course, then we know what happened when he thought maybe the launching of cruise missiles was imminent. Saddam Hussein then began moving hordes of women and little children. And, of course, they're precious little children. You and I have no reason to hate the Iraqi people. We have no reason to hate those people who live, really, a lot of them, lives of squalor, poverty, hardship, and disease. And certainly when we see those little children, our heart goes out to them because they have been perverted and polluted mentally, spiritually, and emotionally by the adult generation and by all of the propaganda that emanates from a wholly corrupt dictatorship. But the little children themselves are not responsible. And so we see the pictures that show us the little children holding up the V for victory sign, all of them holding pictures of Saddam Hussein. And they were herded into his many palaces. The guy has got palaces all over the country, huge palatial estates. The people love it. They come from hovels. They live in shacks. They live in a terrible squalid position. And then they get to spend a few nights maybe sleeping on a Persian rug somewhere in a marble hall in the midst of one of his gigantic palaces as a human shield, so that if the United States dared to bomb those palaces or even some of those chemical factories. And by the way, he was moving human shields, human civilians, men, women, and children into many of the plants that are manufacturing these toxic chemicals and these biological agents, and all of his military establishments as well. Some of these mad dictators act in ways that are just so incredible and so unusual and so hard for the Western mind to comprehend. And think what a difficulty that would be for a young American pilot in an F-117 ordered in there to Baghdad to launch a smart bomb right in the front window of a building in which he knew there were men, women, and little children. That would be awfully, awfully difficult for commanders to order, and it would be awfully difficult for the troops to carry out. In order to understand really what is going on in Iraq and how it impacts the entire Middle East, especially Israel, how it impacts the entire Gulf region, we need to know a little bit about the history, geography, politics, and the economy of Iraq. Iraq occupies much of the area. As I said, it's about the size in square miles of California, a huge area really. And it occupies the area formerly called Mesopotamia, which is merely the Greek word that means the land between the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in this case. And they rise in the mountains to the north of Baghdad, flow into the Persian Gulf along the border between Iraq and Iran. It was in that region that the first major attacks of the eight-year Iraq-Iran war took place in September of 1980. A lot of disputes had broken out at that time between Iraq and Iran over the sovereignty of the Shat el-Arab waterway. That's where the two rivers come together and kind of overflow into each other in the rainy season, and where a tremendous amount of the world's date supply comes from. The ancient land of Mesopotamia has been called, quote, the cradle of civilization, end quote. It was in that region that the Akkadians, the Babylonians, and the Assyrians built their cities and monuments. That's where the Tower of Babel was. The Bible mentions that land many times. Nimrod, the first organizer of man into cities, was the builder of several of the earliest of all cities on earth. The Bible says, over in the book of Genesis, chapter 10, verses 8 to 12, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And that really means in place of, not in front of him, meaning in his view, but he was a mighty hunter before the Lord, meaning that he was looked to as a savior of sorts, that he was showing people how to defend themselves against wild animals, how to gather together in villages and put up walls and to protect themselves and their cattle. Wherefore it is said, quote, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before the Lord, or the Eternal. That began to become his fame and his renown. Quote, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, that's ancient Babylon, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar, and that is Chaldea, or Babylon, modern-day Iraq. Out of that land went forth Asher, actually the margin should read, and he went forth into Assyria and builded Nineveh, meaning Nimrod, and built Nineveh and the city of Rehoboth and Calah, and reason between Nineveh and Calah the same as a great city. The ruins of those ancient cities are virtually undiscernible even by archaeological digs, but most have been uncovered, and of course certain artifacts have been recovered, and we all know the ruins of ancient Babylon are not very far from Baghdad, and that Saddam Hussein was trying to make that a major tourist attraction, that they were trying to restore a good bit of it. Some of the walls, like the Semiramis Gate with their beautiful glazed bricks and so on, of the mosaics and the pictures of the huge Syrian or Assyrian kings and the bull-like body with the winged cherubim actually decorating the walls of those palaces of ancient Babylon, are in the Berlin Museum. It was in that very place that God confounded the languages of ancient man, causing the dispersion of races over the earth. It was after conquests then by the Persians, and you remember the Persian Empire under Cyrus the Great, the Greeks, and remember that Alexander the Great swept into that country and overthrew it, and the Arabs, eventually when Islam held ascendancy in that part of the world. It was then that Mesopotamia ceased to be a separate entity. The Arab conquerors founded Baghdad in a vast area of the entire Middle East, all the way from India, way on over into parts of Europe, was eventually ruled over by a caliphate of Baghdad during the 8th and the 9th centuries. In more recent times, Britain secured a mandate over Iraq following World War I. You might remember that Germany had been stripped of almost all of her foreign possessions by the League of Nations, including the East African colonies like Kenya and Tanzania, the Saar, the Marshalls, the Gilberts in the Pacific, and of course, remember the Danzig Corridor. and the Rhineland was occupied by the troops of the victorious Allies, mostly French. And because the Ottoman Empire was dismantled following World War I, the victorious British gained vast hegemony in the Middle East. By 1932, now we're coming down into my lifetime, Iraq became independent under a king. But socialism, along with a pan-Arab movement, was sweeping the Middle East in those years before and during World War II. And eventually a revolution in Iraq overthrew the monarchy and a republic, in quotes, was formed in 1958. Communist backing had helped accomplish that coup. And that new republic oriented its foreign policy toward the the USSR, toward the Soviet Union. All the large land holdings were broken up. People have had vast estates and what we would call ranches, but over there go by a different name and so on, were broken up. Almost all the industry was nationalized, but along the communist lines. Then came a time of massive trade with the Soviet Union. Iraq's army and air force were equipped with Soviet-made MiGs, radar, communications facilities, tanks, artillery, anti-aircraft missiles and batteries, and all the other infrastructure like command and control centers and communication equipment, as I said. Soviet advisors organized the Iraqi army along Soviet lines. We remember having the general that led our troops in the war, General Schwarzkopf, actually illustrate on his maps, as did Colin Powell, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, of the in-depth defenses that were actually organized along the Soviet lines that Saddam Hussein had organized in southern Iraq and right next to Kuwait. But in the meantime, back then, a local faction of the International Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party rose to power and began ruling by absolute decree commencing in about 1968. A formal aid pact was signed between Iraq and the Soviet Union in 1972, and thousands of Soviet advisors, of course a lot of them spies, a lot of them agents of the KGB, poured into the country. It didn't take too many years until Saddam Hussein and other Iraqis began to realize that by allowing all of those Soviets in there, they were becoming virtually a vassal state, and that the Soviet Union wanted control, along with, of course, the vast Iraqi oil reserves and Persian Gulf warm water ports that the Soviet Union had always sought. Well, some of them went too far. In 1978, there was a kind of a summary trial, and Saddam Hussein's government executed 21 communists who were no doubt found guilty of attempting to overthrow the government. They were Arabs, but they weren't Russians, but they were people who were communists ideologically. So Iraq then began making overtures toward Western countries like Switzerland, Germany, Britain, and of course especially France and even the United States, which chilled relations between Iraq and the Soviet Union. You might remember, too, that in the wars that have occurred between the Arab neighbors around Israel since 1948, that Iraq continually would send forces to aid those other Arab countries. In the 1948 Jewish War for Independence, they did that. They did it again during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, or the war that took place on the Day of Atonement in 1973. These forces were sent to augment the Syrian army, and the Israelis defeated them anyway. At about that time, Saddam Hussein, and I'm going to talk about him and go into his background here with you, came to power. His rise to power is, I remember a book, I don't know if it's still available, it was merely by the title of Saddam Hussein, that became a very big bestseller very quickly in about 1992 when the Gulf War was going, and it was written by, I think, some New York Times reporters, and it had a great deal of biographical information, some of which I can give you. But Saddam Hussein instigated a bloody purge in the wake of an alleged conspiracy to overthrow his regime. That's one thing about bloodthirsty dictators. They're always paranoid. They're always very, very fearful about an overthrow, and they don't trust anybody. So they get their own palace guard. They get people that are very, very, very loyal and faithful to them. And, of course, they've got the power and the money to hand out all kinds of fantastic kudos and wonderful perks and things like fabulous homes and cars and huge salaries. And that's where they get the loyalty. Well, the Kurds, who live primarily in the south, but also in villages along the Euphrates River, along the border with Iran, and up in the northern part of Kurdistan, continually attempted to oust Saddam Hussein. There were years in which Saddam Hussein and his cohorts battled the Kurdish minority, which had been receiving support in the form of manpower, money, and arms from Iran. Saddam Hussein achieved a complete victory over the dissident Kurds inside his own country, and his MiGs bombed Kurdish villages across the border in Iran, which soured relations between those two nations and eventually led to war. For about 10 months back in 1980, Iraq and Iran argued over who controlled that Shat el-Arab confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River, where it empties into the Persian Gulf. As I said, that features some of the heaviest concentrations of date palms in the world, and it's rich in agriculture. Iraqi and Iranian soldiers fought skirmishes all over that region and open warfare, major warfare, featuring artillery, tank attacks, and airstrikes broke out between the two countries on September 22, 1980. Iraq sought to overrun Iran's oil-rich province of Khuzestan, and pitched battles were fought around Abadan and the port of Karamshar. Now, behind the scenes, the United States had looked the other way as Saddam Hussein began acquiring the weapons and technologies he wanted from several European countries. And lots of them were there to do business with him. Swiss, German, French, and British contractors came pouring into that country as Saddam began to build what would become, in about 10 years, the fourth largest army in the world. And to U.S. planners, get this, that seemed perfectly logical. Because just like the United States had rebuilt Germany following World War II as a so-called bulwark against communism, and together with the British and the French formed a strong NATO force to withstand the Warsaw Pact puppets of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, so it seemed logical to allow Saddam Hussein to build a formidable barrier to growing Iranian military might. As you will recall, though President Jimmy Carter had virtually accomplished the release of American hostages in Tehran just prior to leaving office, it was President Reagan who received much of the credit. And remember that President Reagan came into office just as those hostages were coming home. So, of course, Iran was calling the United States the Great Satan. And we know that the Iranians have continually sponsored terrorist acts all over the Middle East and all over Europe, and now even here in the United States. Iran had become a vindictive, bitter enemy of the U.S. and of Israel with the ouster of the Shah and the overthrow of his government, and the dreaded Savak. The Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returned from exile in Paris to take up the reins of government after the Shah was forced out of the country. All Western culture began to be outlawed, and Iran retreated into the black shroud of a fanatical Shiite Muslim church state. The Shiites there are in the majority. It was to the best interests of the Western powers if Iraq and Iran bled each other, so long as their war didn't impede the flow of oil from Gulf ports, and that very quickly became a specter because one or other of the combatants sinking a supertanker in the narrow straits of Hormuz at the southern entrance to the Gulf would have been a nightmare scene and stopped the flow of a tremendous number of supertankers supplying Japan with about 70% of its energy resources, Europe with about 46% of theirs, and the United States with about 17% of ours. So United States naval vessels were sent to the Gulf to protect neutral shipping and to keep the Straits of Hormuz open. Israeli intelligence learned that Saddam Hussein was working on nuclear weapons. As recently as 1991, get this is incredible, Iraq was spending as much as 75% of its gross national product on arms. Isn't that incredible? The people held in poverty while this dictator was building up a vast army and military machine, spending 75% of its gross national product, its GNP, on arms. Well, the Israelis had become deeply concerned over Saddam's buildup and over his nuclear program, and so you might remember the Israeli Air Force launched a sneak attack against a major nuclear reactor at Osirak near Baghdad on June 7, 1981. They were so accurate with their F-16s using conventional bombs, they came in there so fast, so low, and were so accurate that they gutted the plant. We saw pictures of that dome with huge holes in it, absolutely blasted to shards. It became a major international incident, but even though they ranted and raved and screamed and yelled about it and protested and everything, there wasn't anything they could do. It was a done deal. The Israelis simply went in there and took out the plant. And they feel that they had set back this quickly the Iran-Iraq war expanded into the Gulf. It wasn't very long before there were several deliberate attacks on unarmed oil tankers from other neutral nations as each combatant down there sought to damage the economy of the other. You'll remember that because there were big tankers and it showed them in these fast little patrol boats, not much bigger than a speedboat, would charge up to the tankers and unleash rocket and machine gun fire and then speed away. Then, on May 17, 1987, the Iraqis launched a missile attack against the USS Stark, a United States missile-carrying frigate. The Stark itself was a missile-carrying vessel. It had perceived the incoming threat and had turned away, attempting to vacate the area. I was absolutely astonished when I learned that the design of the Stark, with that huge midship superstructure crammed with electronics, radar, missile guidance systems, and communications equipment, didn't have any guns or missiles which could be fired to the rear. They could only fire in the other direction. So while they were turning away and trying to flee the scene, an Iraqi missile slammed into that ship and killed 37 U.S. sailors. The Iraqis, of course, claimed the whole thing had been a big mistake. They apologized for the attack. How times have changed. In the old days, that would have precipitated a massive retaliatory strike against Iraq, if not open war being declared against them immediately. But notwithstanding the howls of outrage from the Navy and the Pentagon, and the 37 families and the hundreds of their kin and thousands of friends and millions of Americans who saw the sad picture of those bodies being brought back, and all of the speeches by politicians to the weeping, grieving loved ones. Millions of Americans watched in horror as that badly damaged ship limped into port, and not a thing was done. As that Iran-Iraq war raged on, by August 1988, after more than 1 million lives had been lost and terrible damage had been done to oil production facilities, Iran accepted a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. Finally, they were just tired of it. All of them had bled each other so badly. Some of those major oil ports were in such a shambles, they simply wanted it over with. Now, of course, Saddam, with his hands freed from Iran, began looking greedily southward. And there was little oil-rich Kuwait, which, of course, Saddam called the 19th province of Iraq. Kuwait was like a crown jewel in the Gulf, with hundreds and hundreds of oil wells pumping black gold out of the earth, both from the desert sands and rigs in the Gulf. Kuwait was the richest per capita country on earth. It's amazing when you think about it. That little country was founded in 1759 under the Al-Sabah dynasty, and some of their progeny are still on the throne. Kuwait back then was only a sleepy little desert town at the north end of the Persian Gulf, but Great Britain, because of gradually developing oil interests and political considerations, took over the running of foreign relations and defense from just before the turn of the century until 1961. Even today, 96% of the population of Kuwait lives in cities, mostly in Kuwait City. There are very few native Kuwaitis in Kuwait. The vast majority of the population is non-Kuwaiti and includes a very large number of Palestinian Arabs, along with a lot of Europeans and people from countries all over the world, including Japanese and others. None of them, though, if they're not a citizen, can vote. But get this, there are no taxes in Kuwait. The vast income derived from oil sales provides free medical care, free education, and free social security. The only taxes of any kind that are levied are those from customs duties. People traveling to Kuwait or shipments of goods to Kuwait that have to pay customs duties. Kuwait supported Saddam Hussein during the war against Iran, and look what they got for it. They supported him in his war against Iran. So Iranian patrol boats began attacking Kuwaiti ports. And that's why U.S. warships were sent to escort Kuwaiti tankers back in 1987, which led to the missile attack on the USS Stark. Saddam Hussein began moving major elements of his army toward Kuwait in July of 1990. He actually convinced himself that the world would stand by and allow him to gobble up tiny Kuwait and do nothing. And his miscalculation was based upon what one of our own assistant secretaries of state said. That devastating war in the Gulf could have been avoided long ago if it hadn't been for greed, compromise, and expediency. Because, you know, for more than a decade, Saddam Hussein have been quietly putting together the fourth largest superbly equipped war machine in the world, and he had been helped by Germans, French, British, Italians, and people in Switzerland and the United States, as well as the Russians. It was in late July 1990, and it was only days before Saddam invaded Kuwait back then, that U.S. officials asked Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly what the United States would do if Iraq invaded. Kelly told them, and these are his words, the U.S. has no commitments to Kuwait, end quote. When the CIA warned the administration on August 1st back then that an invasion was imminent, the State Department didn't even issue a warning to tourists in the region. You know, when you really think about it, because of the expediency of once again trying to have a bulwark against a feared enemy, meaning Iran, worried about the overthrow of the Shah and the rise to power of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the American hostage crisis, and eventually the Americans being released, but the Iranians becoming an exporter of terrorists all over the world, and what they would do next, and whether they were headed toward chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons programs. The idea was, we need to build up Saddam Hussein and help him to become a bulwark against Iran. We saw Iran looming as a major power in the area, and it was just, again, some of the selective choosing as to with whom American officials decide to cooperate that they decided to go ahead and to help build up Saddam Hussein. It's really a terrible black eye when you stop to think about it for U.S. diplomacy and a clear failure on the part of U.S. intelligence agencies and the national security advisors to the government. When the Carter administration attempted to pull off that Israeli-like rescue, you remember, only to ignominiously fail when rescue aircraft collided in a Keystone Cop-like mix-up, the United States appeared to the world just like another bumbling, fumbling paper tiger. And the Ayatollah Khomeini had advanced to the point to where everyone thought that he was one of the most powerful people in the world. And he had Forrestal-class destroyers, hovercraft landing vehicles, sophisticated tank-destroying helicopters, an impressive array of anti-aircraft weapons, conventional and sophisticated. He had tanks, infantry weapons, including wire-guided TOWs, and even shoulder-held Stingers anti-aircraft missiles. So now, a former friend had become a bitter enemy. And when you think about the Carter administration, so much for sanctimonious Bible Belt religious notions about human rights around the world. Rather, it was revealed the United States was perfectly willing, no matter who was in the Oval Office, to selectively apply morality to this or that repressive, bloody dictator, depending on what were the U.S. interests. When the Iraqi Air Force bombed Iran on September 17, 1980, the United States was quietly pleased. Now, Saddam Hussein had moved into the gap to achieve a more reasonable balance of power in the Middle East. And Saddam, it was thought, was a man with whom the United States could easily do business. So it was not only the United States who looked upon Saddam as a potential business partner and a force for balance and stability in the Middle East, because they didn't know what he would do to Kuwait. France was helping Saddam with much of his shopping list for modern military technology, which included things like Mirage Mystère fighter bombers, that Exocet missile of Falklands Island fame, the type that struck the USS Stark. And you know, chillingly, French President François Mitterrand of that time promised to supply Saddam with uranium fuel for his new reactor, which was nearing completion when the Israelis struck it back in 1981. Throughout the 1980s, businessmen from all those countries and the United States were beating a path to Saddam's door. Illegal loans were arranged by an Italian bank for various American, West German, and British companies with ties to Iraq. The Import-Export Bank assured loans for delivering American-made pesticides to Iraq. Get that? American-made pesticides were sent there. And what can those be used for? As you know, it was really a pesticide that was used to kill and to murder hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Jews during World War II, in Hitler's pogroms during the Holocaust. Officials were told, of course, that such chemicals would be used only for peaceful purposes, like spraying bugs. But, you know, such official assurances are all that is usually needed to those blinded by their lust for quick profits. Italy's company that was called SNIA BPD established various subsidiary companies set up by former employees to assist in sending technology and manufactured goods to Iraq. And it was a West German firm, the Karl Kolb GmbH, which helped in constructing 6 chemical plants there, ostensibly for the manufacture of pesticides, which led to Saddam's announcement. He said it himself. He made the announcement in late 1983. He could now produce chemical weapons. And look who provided him with the technology. And only 5 years later, he used those weapons against his own people, against the Kurds, both in Iraq and in Iran. Because for years they had wanted independence. And finally, because Saddam Hussein was stung by this rejection of his most exalted and beneficent person, he ordered his air force and army into action against the Kurdish civilian population. Helpless civilians in their villages found long-range artillery shells raining down, and they had mustard gas and other kinds of things like pesticides and who knows what in them. And you remember probably seeing in the weekly news magazines pictures of the bloated bodies of Kurdish women and children lying where they fell in the streets of their villages. The mortality will never be accurately known, but it's estimated that more than 5,000 civilians, including elderly and women and children, died. I was horrified. I know you must have been too when you saw those video clips of that genocidal brutality. Bodies lying in doorways, women clutching children to their bosoms, bloated, misshapen bodies everywhere. Victims of poison gas from exploding warheads. In terror, more than 70,000 Kurds fled across the Turkish border. I want to tell you a little bit about Saddam before we get to some prophecies in Daniel 11 right quickly. Saddam was born in a tiny village back in 1937. He's only 7 years younger than I am. And he was born to a family living in the traditional squalor, filth, and poverty of that nation. The typical houses in that little village of Takrit in Iraq were like most others in a kind of a cow dung society, people living in little mud shelters, no hygienic facilities, no running water, no electricity, and often burning dried cow chips for fuel. Not a great deal is known about his early years, but it's claimed that his father died when Saddam was only a baby, and that Saddam never even knew his real father. Saddam's stepfather allegedly abused the child and rejected him. Saddam Hussein is said to have related how his stepfather called him a son of a whore or a son of a dog and sent him into the surrounding countryside to steal sheep and chickens for the family larder or for resale for profit. Saddam didn't even begin school till he was 10 and didn't achieve the equivalent of a high school education, and we're not sure even how much that was, until he was 26. He wasn't much of a student. He wanted to gain admittance into the Baghdad Military Academy, but his poor grades and lack of education prevented it, so he never had any military experience, even though he really believes that he is a great military strategist and decided to appoint himself as the rank of lieutenant general, which wasn't bad for a man who'd never even been a private or a corporal and never had a day's military experience. For years, Saddam Hussein did, though, study in Baghdad and later on in Egypt, and like many other fanatical young Arabs of that time, he became engaged in various political intrigues. He was an especial admired Lieutenant Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser, who overthrew King Farouk in Egypt in 1952. When Saddam was only 20, he became a member of one of the nationalist political parties, the Ba'ath Party, which at that time was a totally insignificant group of political activists in Iraq, which only numbered a few hundred. About 2 years after Saddam became active in that party, the Ba'athist Party, some nationalist army officers who were not Ba'athist staged a military coup which overthrew King Faisal II. Faisal was the son of the original Faisal I, who had been installed by the British following that British mandate I mentioned to you back in 1922. In about a year, the Ba'athist Party attempted to grab power in Iraq by pulling off the assassination of General Abdul Karim Qasim, who had led the military coup. Allegedly, Saddam was one of the machine gunners in the attempt on Qasim's life, but it failed. And by the way, there is biological information that reveals that Saddam had murdered a communist supporter of Qasim's in Saddam's home village of Takrit. And by the way, the Ba'athist Party was violently anti-communist, and it was alleged that Saddam's uncle had incited Saddam to carry out the murder, and the murdered man was Saddam's brother-in-law.
Well, the coup failed, and so Saddam fled to Egypt. And he was arrested twice while he was there for threatening to kill fellow Iraqi students over political arguments. When a group of Ba'athist army officers and other Arab nationalists finally did succeed in killing Qasim, Saddam Hussein rushed back to Iraq to join other members of the Ba'athist party and claim his rightful place in a revolution. He was made interrogator and torturer in the Qasr al-Nihaya, which meant the place or palace of the end. The name came from the place where King Faisal and his entire family had been brutally shot to death in 1958. There was a terrible, horrible, grisly torture chamber located under the palace and was utilized for years by the Ba'athist party with Saddam in charge. And there were shocking, grisly stories, revolting stories of torture, of hideous instruments including pincers, electric wires, and sharpened metal stakes on which prisoners were forced to sit, and a machine for chopping off fingers that were discovered in that torture chamber. Well, the party split. Saddam briefly was jailed. He once more became active in the Ba'athist party, and he was active in the party's internal security apparatus, which translates into the Gestapo. And though the original coup had been carried out by a combined group of Ba'athist and National Army officers, it was on July 30th, 68, that Saddam and his cohorts finally grabbed power. He was called deputy chairman of the council and was now completely in charge of internal security. Among other things, Saddam oversaw the secret training school for that party police force and saw to it that various of his half-brothers, cousins, and other close relatives graduated from such schools. Shortly after taking power, that new regime hung 14 spies, allegedly part of a Zionist spy ring, and most of those hung in the Liberation Square in downtown Baghdad were Jews. And the next 18 months was hideous. History proves there were a stream of executions, probably most of all of which were preceded by torture. Saddam Hussein was actually said to have watched and laughed while he slowly lowered one of his opponents into a bath of acid. Saddam Hussein sees himself as another Nebuchadnezzar II. He sees himself as a Saladin. He sees himself as a leader in the entire Arab world. Some people think he's crazy. Others say he's intelligent, cunning, and far from crazy. Others have said he's not crazy, he's just evil. But what does Saddam Hussein want? He wants to be the leading Arab in the world. He wants to be the leader of all the Arab countries. Now, the biblical prophecy of Daniel, the 11th chapter, beginning in verse 40, talks about how eventually things are going to get so bad that a king of the south, who may or may not be an Iraqi, he could be an Egyptian, some other leader, maybe even Saudi Arabian, we do not know yet because we don't know who is the king of the south at this moment. But he will somehow push at a king of the north, which we believe means a United States of Europe, which is arising. And that king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, it says in verse 40 of Daniel 11, and enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, talking about Palestine, and many countries shall be overthrown. What would bring about some kind of a shoving match between a leading Arab, who is now like the head of a pan-Arab union, and the Western powers in Europe? Obviously, since they react by advancing into Palestine and occupy Israel, it is very likely the scenario that is portrayed by Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place where it ought not, which is talking about a hideous abomination, not only as an icon or an idol, but a living human being called the Antichrist, called the false prophet, that is mentioned in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, who will sit in a temple of God, showing, claiming that he is God, and will have the power to produce such great miracles he will deceive millions of human beings into thinking he's literally God, or like a false Christ who has somehow appeared on this earth. There is going to be a flashpoint which is going to trigger a nuclear bomb, World War III. In order to try to stop it, there is going to be a huge allied force from Europe, which is going to enter into the Middle East and to occupy Palestine. It says, many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. And that seems to indicate Turkey and perhaps Syria, some of those other peoples there, and the chief of the children of Ammon, and Ammon is the capital of Jordan today. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So even Egypt is going to be attacked. Now that makes you think, as you read the prophecy, that this king of the south is going to be an Egyptian. Traditionally, in past years, he was. Because this is referring to a whole series of wars between the Ptolemies of Egypt, a lesser line of pharaohs, and the Seleucidae of Syria at that time, when Palestine was overrun on many different occasions. He, this king of the north, will have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians, and that does not necessarily mean political Libya on the Cyrenaican Peninsula in northern Africa. It means push, or I should say Kush and Put, and that can also indicate such nations as India and Pakistan, as well as perhaps the Sudan. But it says they will be at his steps, meaning at the farthest point of his advance into the Middle East, into Palestine, absorbing Israel and all the way into Egypt. Then it says, tidings out of the east and the north. And what is east and north? Here is the vast land mass of Asia. Farther east of that, China. Even further east, Japan. With gigantic interests in the Middle East. 70% of their life's blood, of the oil that fuels their industry and their shipping and their tankers and their aircraft and their automobiles and all of their factories has to come from the Persian Gulf. So no wonder with these eastern powers, Russia, China, all the nations to the east and the north of Palestine be terribly disturbed and troubled if they saw a war breaking out there. They would come in to try to stop it. It says, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly make away many. In other words, intelligence will tell the beast power who is occupying Jerusalem and Palestine that he is about to be attacked by these other people, and he steals the march on them and attacks them first. And it says, at that time he will plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas, talking about the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, speaking of Jerusalem, in the glorious holy mountain, and he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. And that prophecy leads directly on into the next chapter. Remember that men added the chapters and the verses. They were not in the original Bible. And at that time, when that terrible war is going on, a nuclear World War III, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Read Matthew 24, 21 and 22. That is describing the identical time. For then shall be great tribulation such as was not from the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever indeed shall be, said Jesus Christ. What triggers the great tribulation? A king of the south pushes at the king of the north. And the fulcrum between these two vying powers that brings about this great move has something to do with Israel, because it says he, this king of the north, is going to move into the glorious land and the place where he plants his headquarters, called his palace, or the tabernacles of his palace. That is his supreme military and his spiritual headquarters. And when you look at that, combining it with 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, you come to understand. Now, here's what you need to do if you don't have it yet. You need to read my booklet entitled The Abomination of Desolation, because it goes thoroughly behind the entire history of it all, shows you exactly what it is and who it is. Then you need to get the booklet, which is really informative about all this and goes into far more of the prophecies than I've had time to do on this tape called Should We Fear Iraq? Or Should We Fear Saddam Hussein? But that is the book about the beast of the apocalypse. Those two, if you get the beast of the apocalypse tape, and you get the, or booklet rather, and if you get the booklet entitled The Abomination of Desolation, remember that, and I'll say it again slowly so you can write it down. Well, you can listen to the tape twice, but get the booklets called The Abomination of Desolation and The Beast of the Apocalypse if you haven't read them. And all of this in the book of Daniel, and Matthew 24, and Luke 21, and many of the prophecies in the book of Revelation will come very, very clear to you, and you will understand. You know, Hitler played out a kind of a, what was called in the Wagnerian operas, Götterdämmerung, and that meant twilight of the gods. And Hitler was enthralled by the dark mythological foreboding and demonic theme of that old opera that Wagner had written. So Hitler played it out his own life. While he was cowering in his Führer bunkers, Berlin was being bombed to rubble, and thousands of Soviet tanks and artillery assaulted the city, he was saying bitterly that the German people were not worthy of him. I'm telling you that Saddam Hussein is, in his own way, crazy. Anyone who would use those kinds of horrifying weapons against his own people, anyone who would be storing anthrax and this VX chemical, has got to be crazy to want to use that against innocent, helpless men, women, and children. An expert I told you on the television program showed a nozzle that appeared to be stainless steel and brass. It was a military spraying nozzle for use in spraying bacteriological agents by the armed forces of the United States. But we have outlawed that, but we still have stockpiles of them. He said he had carried it through numerous airports, and when asked about it, he would just tell them, oh, it's just a plumbing fixture. And he got right on through, and they said, oh, well, if that's all it is, go right ahead. So, of course, as I revealed on that television program, and that was the reason he picked up the phone and called and wanted to get this tape, just like that clipping said, be afraid. And yet, I don't think you and I need to fear Saddam Hussein where we live, but who knows? The man is absolutely mad, and who knows what kind of terrorist attacks are going to be perpetrated against the United States and certainly against Israel. But I've always said time and time again, I remind you again in closing, that the flashpoint which is going to ignite another major war is Israel. And with all this happening, with American great big nuclear battle carriers being rushed to the scene, with American bombers flying over there, with American troops loading and going over there again, and even as I talk with Saddam Hussein obfuscating and delaying and trying to deny entry to these people into the very places where Saddam Hussein is busily building biological and chemical weapons and maybe even working on a nuclear program, we are living in very dangerous times. We're living in the times just before the outbreak of the Great Tribulation. I've said time and again, which is why we have a publication called 21st Century Watch, that Jesus Christ said, watch you therefore, and pray always that you might be worthy to be accounted to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Get those two booklets I talked about, please. They're free of charge. All you've got to do is to call 903-825-2525. Till next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.